Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books, an independent New Orleans bookstore. Additional support comes from the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, WWNO's weekly look at the New Orleans literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. Today we're getting ready for that annual July celebration, Tales of the Cocktail, with Jeff Berry, author of Potions of the Caribbean, 500 Years of Tropical Drinks and the People Behind Them. And bookseller Judith Lafitte of Octavia Books talks about the return of a Storyville Blue Book. Jeff Beachbum Berry lives a life to envy. He's a cocktail historian with a flair for the elegant phrase, the tantalizing drink recipe, and the story behind the drinks we love, the daiquiri, the Mai Tai, the Cuba Libre. Is it any wonder he's ended up in New Orleans? His new book is Potions of the Caribbean, 500 Years of Tropical Drinks and the People Behind Them. How I love to say that title. He'll be one of the featured speakers at the upcoming Tales of the Cocktail this week. Jeff Berry, welcome to The Reading Life.
Pleasure to be here, Susan. Thank you.
Now, this book is so much fun. It's bright and beautiful with 77 cocktail recipes, gorgeous vintage illustrations, and it looks so festive. But so much of the history here is really pretty grim.
Yes, and that was not something I knew when I got into the book, when I first started researching it and writing it. I absolutely knew nothing about Caribbean history beyond the usual talking points of high school and college history classes. And to write a book like this, I realized eventually that you can't write about the drinks without talking about the context for the drinks. You can't write about Cuban drinks without writing about Cuba. You can't write about Jamaican drinks without writing about Jamaica. And in the case of the Caribbean, that history, at least the history that's taught and written about, stretches back to 1492 with Columbus.
Right.
As I started to do the research, it just got more and more depressing.
Oh, no. the
Caribbean was a very depressing place for centuries. You start off with the conquest, which brings with it genocide and epidemics and religious persecution and slavery and all that good stuff. And it just keeps going from there. The more countries that enter the territory to try and wrest it away from the Spanish, then you get more bloodshed and more oppression of the locals who weren't wiped out to begin with. And as I started to do this, I was, I'm supposed to be writing about cocktails. This is supposed to be fun.
Oh, yeah.
But I started off with James Michener's novel, Caribbean.
Of course.
Because I'm lazy and it seemed like a really easy way to learn about the 500 years just in the form of an easily digestible mass market piece of fiction, which is very historically minded. And that was a decent grounding, but it quickly disabused me of the notion of reading any more fiction about the Caribbean. It was beyond phoned in as far as the actual fiction part.
Uh-huh.
And I found that not only historical fiction, but historical academic works about the Caribbean were, if they weren't too dry, no pun intended, they were too focused on one particular aspect of the history. And what I wanted to do was a popular history. I wanted to do something broad that just filled in the broad strokes of what was going on so that you could understand how and why these drinks were invented and get a little bit of background on who was drinking them and all that. So it was 5 years. It took five years just to write a recipe book, which is not really the most economically viable way to, you know, write recipe books.
Heavy investment of time,
yeah.
Right? Now, the illustrations, which are so lovely, you have works of art, you have so much ephemera, you have posters and menus and these gorgeous fragile things from this very human climate. So talk a little bit about collecting those things, those items.
Funny you should mention that, Susan, because I started my journey into cocktails as a collector of objects, as a collector of tiki mugs. and gradually from that as a collector of recipes. And I've always been an inveterate thrift shopper and swap meet habitué. And when I met my wife, Anine, a.k.a. Mrs. Bum, she was even more into it than I was. So that's really where I came from. And the book, fortunately, the publisher was just as much of a cocktail geek as I am. Greg Bohm over at Cocktail Kingdom, he has an even bigger collection of ephemera than I do, and a lot of his stuff's actually in the book. So he was very simpatico about making this a full-color picture book. I'm really glad to hear you say that you enjoyed that part of it, because each one does speak 1,000 words.
Really?
When you see a drink photographed in the actual vessel that it was served in the 1930s in Havana, it tells you a lot, the logo.
Oh, yeah.
It's even got the address on it, some of the logo drinkware, and we have pre-Columbian drinkware for some of those drinks, and things like postcards from restaurants and bars, and movie posters when we talk about movie stars going down there.
Yeah.
It really, for me, was a very exciting thing to be able to put all that stuff between covers and not just have it in my own library.
And this is a book that's populated with great characters. Trader Vic, for example. That's a name everybody knows, but you have the real story.
Yes. One of the things that led me to write about the Caribbean to begin with was Trader Vic.
Mm-hmm.
I first got interested in tiki drinks just by going to Trader Vic's in Los Angeles, and the drinks really impressed me. I mean, I was just old enough to start drinking. I was 21, 22. Couldn't really afford to go there, but I could afford one or two drinks. And in the 1980s, when I started off, these were the last of the true farm-to-table culinary craft cocktails being served. I mean, it was the cocktail dark ages, the 1980s. Nothing good was being done. Everything was coming out of a bottle of sweet and sour mix or out of a can. And the tiki bars that were left were still doing the real thing with fresh fruit juices and bespoke syrups and liqueurs and ingredients more common to the kitchen and to the bar. And these were the only drinks that stood out for me in the 80s. So I pursued them and went to every tiki bar I could find, and Trader Vic's was the best one. And gradually, I started to collect his books. He wrote 9 of them,
mm-hmm.
and started to learn a little bit about him. And I thought, God, I really would love to write about this guy. And the Caribbean thing was perfect, because I found out after writing 4 books about tiki drinks, I found out that the Caribbean was really where it all started. This is where he went in 1937 to find out how to make tropical drinks. So there's a whole big Venn diagram circle in the middle where tiki and the Caribbean thing meet, and it's Trader Vic.
Wow. Well, it's so funny because it's hard for me to think of the cocktail dark ages, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But it is. It is such a long, long history. Now, you also have some literary ties in this book. Of course, Ernest Hemingway and Graham Greene.
My dirty little secret is that I'm bored writing about cocktails. What can you say about a cocktail? Okay, there's liquor in it. There's a modifier. There's some juice. I love cocktails, and I like finding recipes, and I love recipe books for what they give me. But in terms of settling down at the end of the day with a good book, curling up with a good book, a recipe book is not a good book to curl up to.
Mm.
And for me, what makes good cocktail writing is writing about the people behind the drinks. And I struck gold in terms of a writer with the Caribbean, because everybody went down there. Anybody was anybody. Some people like Hemingway, Noel Coward, Graham Greene spent a lot of time down there. And of course, I was fascinated by all 3 of those people. So as I researched and dug deeper, I found, hey, they like particular drinks in the Caribbean, and I could tie them in there, and I can make excuses for writing about some writers that I admired in the context of drinks. And you also had movie stars. You had Errol Flynn. You had JFK coming down, and the daiquiri was his favorite drink.
The daiquiri, I know. Yeah. It was so interesting.
And equally interesting to me, alongside all of these literary figures and movie stars and captains of industry who came down, some of the people who invented these drinks, like we mentioned Trader Vic, he had a fascinating life story of his own.
Yeah.
And so did a guy named Joe Shalom, who migrated to the Caribbean from Cairo after surviving 2 revolutions and walked right into another one when Castro took over Havana, which is where he was. So the book really grew out of these people. And once I got a grounding of the historical timeline, there are other books for that. I don't really need to be doing that. But I have the historical timeline. I have the recipes to plug into that. And then, who made them? Who drank them? why were they popular? And these people all started just to pop up. I mean, I was thrilled when people like Noel Coward popped up and when Graham Greene popped up and when, of course, we knew Hemingway was, you know, he lived in Havana. But and I was thrilled to discover somebody like Joe Shalom, who spoke eight languages and survived three revolutions, was working down there. He only worked down there for a couple of years, so I cheated a little bit writing an entire chapter about him.
But it was worth it. And he was like a destination bartender. You know, people would go to have his drinks.
He was the most famous bartender in the world at one point. Nobody remembers him now, but in the 1940s, you had every war correspondent in the Middle East congregating at Shepherd's Hotel in Cairo, where Joe Shalom was the head bartender. And when they had nothing to write about in the desert campaign, they wrote about him because he was such a fascinating guy and because he was such a great host and just really knew how to entertain people and how to converse with people and invented a drink called the Suffering Bastard or Suffering Bar Steward, depending on your sensibilities, as a hangover cure, which allegedly helped the British desert rats of Montgomery's 8th Army win the Battle of El Alamein when he had taxi drivers ferry 8 gallons of it up to the front because they were all hungover when they had to go fight Rommel. So true or not, I don't know, but great story. So I put it in.
Absolutely. Oh, and I understand you're about to open your own bar this fall.
Yeah. After 6 books about tropical drinks, I figured it was time to stop writing about them and start serving them. So that's what we're doing. And we've got drinks on the menu from some of my favorite people, from Joe Shalom and Trader Vic and Don the Beachcomber, the other great tiki inventor. It's called Latitude 29 or Beach Bumberry's Latitude 29. And it is going to be right in the heart of the French Quarter in the Bienville House Hotel, formerly the home of Iris Restaurant. We're taking over that space. And we're opening in September, probably toward the end of the month. And it was kind of a 10-year process to get down here and open the bar, but this was really the only city in the world that we would even consider opening a place. We fell in love with New Orleans in the summer of 2005, in August of 2005.
Wow.
We were invited down here for Tales of the Cocktail. And we were trying to figure out where to move to from Los Angeles, where I'd spent most of my life, and nothing was really sending us. And we stepped out of the airport shuttle into the French Quarter, and where's this place been all our lives? And everybody we met was great, and everywhere we ate was great, and everywhere we drank was great, and the music was great, and the architecture was great. And in about a few days, we'd been set up with a place to live and with some job offers. I was full-time writer back then, and everything was fantastic. We got back home to L.A., turned on the TV, and, oh, look, they're having a little weather down there.
And so you came anyway.
We came anyway. So we were delayed a little bit, but we came anyway. And, I mean, the joie de vivre of this town, I mean, people talk about it, travel writers talk about it. It's become something of a cliche, but cliches are cliches for a reason. Right. They start off with a foundation of truth. And this place, we just love the city, and we just really want to host people here.
Well, it seems like a fine place to be a beach bum of sorts, you know?
Yeah, not the greatest beaches in the world, but the bum part, you can be very well served in New Orleans. Well, the work ethic of New Orleans, or rather the lack thereof, is something that we really responded to.
And now you'll have your own literary bar we can all visit.
Hopefully, yeah.
We've been talking with Jeff Beach Bum Berry. Fine thing indeed to be a beach bum, whose new book is Potions of the Caribbean, 500 Years of Tropical Drinks and the People Behind Them. You can meet him at Tales of the Cocktail this week. He'll be talking about Tales of the Floridita Thursday morning at 10 at the Queen Anne Ballroom at the Hotel Monteleone, and appearing behind the bar with Nick Dietrich at Cane and Table, Friday from 6 to 8. Check out talesofthecocktail.com for ticket info. Thank you so much, Jeff.
My pleasure, Sissy.
Great curiosities in New Orleans literary history is a series of volumes called Blue Books, published between 1898 and 1915. They were guides to that notorious district of Storyville, addresses of brothels and directories of madams and the prostitutes themselves. They included ads for cigars and whiskey and taxis and lawyers. There were at least 16 blue books published, but few of them were dated, and not too many survived, as they were used and discarded. These little volumes are quite rare, but a reproduction of one has recently been popping up in bookstores, reissued as the local curiosity it is. My guest is Judith Lafitte of Octavia Books, who's the owner of the original 1903 blue book that's been reprinted. Hi, Judith.
Hello, Susan.
Now, this is a story that shows you really should hang on to all those old family things, isn't it?
Absolutely. Never throw things in the garbage because you never know what someone else might pick up and discover. So hang on to that stuff.
So how did you come to own this little thing?
It was actually given to me by my mother's third husband. He had it in his family, and he knew because I was being a bookstore owner that I should have it. So it got passed on to me, which was really interesting.
What did you think when you got it?
Well, when I looked at it, at first I didn't know what it was. And then as I went through the pages, then I realized what it really is. And that was very surprising, exciting, fun to look at, read all the descriptions of the madams and the stories. And it was really fun, very fun.
So how long have you had it? Why take it out now?
Octavia Books has been doing Tales of a Cocktail for about 5 or 6 years now. Uh-huh. And we are always looking for new and exciting things to have at the event. So we thought, wouldn't it be cool to try to get someone interested in reprinting it? And we did. We found a small little publisher who was very interested when we showed it to them. And so we have it at the store, and we're hoping when Tales of a Cocktail comes around, we'll be featuring it there.
Oh, how interesting. Now, we do know that these directories were probably written by a police reporter named Billy Struve, who had his own ties to Storyville. He managed Alexander Storyville's saloon, and he printed the blue book in an office above Lulu White's famous saloon.
That's funny.
I know, isn't that strange?
That's very strange.
Police reporter knows all, obviously.
Of course.
So, aren't there some little idiosyncrasies that mark this version?
When I was handed the blue book by my stepfather, whose name is Joseph Arnold, he actually told me a story that indicated that on one of the pages, there's a little check mark indicating that that is a place that he went to as a young adult to learn to be a man, become, you know, whatever you do to, you know, to do that.
And in New Orleans, it can be many things.
It can be. And so to be very authentic with the reproduction, they actually kept the little check mark on the page, which was pretty funny, actually. So,
and how do people react to this in the bookstore?
Oh, we've had a few, you know, people pick it up, but mostly I've been giving it to all the family members because I think it's such an interesting piece of history for the city. And when I gave it to Tom's nieces, they looked at it and knew immediately what it was. But his nephew, it took a little bit of time to figure out. I mean, he had to read through a couple of pages before the light bulb went off and he knew what it was.
But it's so interesting the way books can, you know, disappear and resurface in this way.
Yeah, I'm not quite sure, you know, why it did that. I saw a segment of Antiques Roadshow that was dated 2001, where the appraiser looked at it and had a really nice chuckle over it and said it was worth anywhere from $3,500 to $4,500. And the person who was presenting the book for the program actually found it in someone's attic that they were clearing out. So you never know what you're going to get your hands on and what it's going to be worth. So
was there an episode of Antiques Roadshow set in New Orleans?
Yes.
Whoa.
It was.
So now that you've seen this on Antiques Roadshow, you must be taking really good care of your copy.
Yes, I am. Mm. Because the book that the gentleman had on the program was in all black and white text, where mine is in red and black. So I think mine is a much older version than the one that was on the program. So that excites me, but I just made a note of it and stuck it inside where the book is. So I'm just holding onto it. I'm never getting rid of this little item, which is, I mean, it's a gem totally.
Oh, yeah.
So
So what did you learn when you actually read through it? Anything new? What struck you?
What struck me was the way that the book is put together. So you have that sort of racial segmentation of, you know, so you have the white segment, you have the black segment, and then there is the
French.
The French. And that was really interesting to me. Then also some of the ads that are in there are still very prevalent today. So you have Veuve Clicquot in there, which is, you know, still being produced. And there are some other ads in there that are still going today. So the other thing was some of the descriptions of the madams talking about coming to their location because of something specific that they have that's better than somebody else.
Yes. It's very competitive.
Yes, very.
Oh, I love this one from Miss Bertha Weinthal, who says, if it were in my power to name kings and queens, I would certainly go out of my way to bestow the title of Queen of Smile on Miss Weinthal. And there's an ad in this one for the famous Mademoiselle Rita Walker in full costume, one of the first women in America to dance in her bare feet. Aside from her marvelous dancing, Mademoiselle has a $5,000 wardrobe, which she uses for her dances, which apparently does not include shoes.
I'm sure not.
Anyway, it's just such a treat to look through this, isn't it?
It's totally fun.
Oh.
And now that I have a reproduced copy of it, I can peruse it even more and not feel guilty about looking at it and getting smudges on the pages.
And keep it wrapped up in plastic.
Exactly.
Oh, we've been talking with Judith Lafitte of Octavia Books about this reprinted version of one of Storyville's famed blue books. Thanks so much, Judith.
You're very welcome. Thank you, Susan.
He met Mama lie down in old New Orleans, and struck in her stuff on the street. She'd say, hello, hey Joe, you wanna give it a go?
I love songs about reading and books. They're the musical equivalent of a comfy chair with a good lamp. Now, we all have our fantasies about librarians, and Jonah Cohen gives full play to them in Library Girl.
It's been a while, probably won't last very long, but in your smile, all those cliches melt away. I'm glowing inside, but I don't even know you very well. What's your favorite color? Mine's brushing obvious to tell. It's getting dark these days, so let a bright one in. I know we're only studying. Make me wanna write a brand new love song, even though we're not in love. When you hit me with those eyes, I can't help thinking that'll maybe something's up. I know that we're only in the library. It's too bad you only wanna stay out in the lobby. I wrote you a song, it's a nothing really. What's your baby doing? There's someone card, read it to me. It's getting dark these days, so let a bright one in. No, we're only studying. Make me wanna write a brand new love song, even though we're not in love. When you hit me with those eyes, I can't help thinking that'll maybe something's up. It's too easy to get serious in this world, for another day. Right now, baby, I know that I'm smiling. That's all I gotta say. Hey, I'll try not
to go much farther than tonight. When my heart is heavy, I'll try to lighten up. I know that we're only in the library, but that's enough. Sometimes you gotta say it's good enough. You make me wanna brand new love song. Even though we're not in love, when you hit me with those eyes, I can't help thinking, now baby, that'll maybe, that'll maybe, yeah, that'll maybe.
Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. Patty Callahan Henry signs The Stories We Tell, Tuesday, July 15th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. George Gertner discusses and signs his new book, Cast of Characters, Wednesday, July 16th at 7 p.m. at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. And there will be an adult spelling bee Wednesday, July 16th at 7 at the West Bank Regional Library in Harvey. Today's guest, Jeff Beachbum Berry, appears at Tales of the Cocktail this week. He'll be talking about Tales of the Floridita, Thursday morning at 10 at the Queen Anne Ballroom at the Hotel Monteleone. He'll be appearing behind the bar with Nick Dietrich at Cane and Table, Friday from 6 to 8. Check out talesofthecocktail.com for ticket info, as well as more information about the authors who will be appearing Wednesday through Sunday, July 16th through 20th, and check out the bookstore at the Hotel Monteleone. Poet Christine Stroud, author of The Buried Return, and novelist Sarah Shotland, author of Junket, read from their work Friday, July 18th at 9 at The Bakery. That's 2448 North Villery Street. Scott Damian discusses and signs Voice, A Stutterer's Odyssey, Saturday, July 19th at 1 at Barnes & Noble Metairie. There will be a tribute to the late Maya Angelou Saturday, July 19th at 2 at the Algiers Regional Library. Participants will include Leslie Ellison, Second City Court Judge E. Tina Anderson Trahan, lawyer Michelle Bennett, artist Ronald Jones, poets, educators, and students. The event is hosted by Barbara Cheatham, Anita Dennis, and Robin Lovely. There will be an open mic reading Sunday, July 20th at 3 at the Maple Leaf Bar. Laura Lane McNeil reads from and signs her new novel, Doll Baby, Sunday, July 20th at 2:30 at Faulkner House Books, and again Monday, July 21st at 6 at Octavia Books. Ed Haslam discusses and signs Dr. Mary's Monkey, How the Unsolved Murder of a Doctor, a Secret Laboratory in New Orleans, and Cancer-Causing Monkey Viruses are linked to Lee Harvey Oswald, the JFK assassination, and emerging global epidemics. Monday, July 21st at 7 at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. Josh Weil signs The Great Glass Sea, Tuesday, July 22nd at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. And we're halfway through the hunt for the children's book character Waldo at various locations uptown. That's all throughout the month of July. Get your Waldo passport at Octavia Books and see how many stamps you can gather before the big Where's Waldo party July 31st at 5 at Octavia Books. Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Christwood Retirement Community, Our Lady of Holy Cross College, and the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. The theme song and end music for The Reading Life is by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by Jenny Lawson and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org. Or you can email us anytime at thereadinglife@wwno.org. I'm Susan Larson. Thanks for listening and keep reading.